Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Thursday, October 8, 2015. My brother Dan has a birthday today, and Kevin McCarthy won't be the speaker.
Meet in secret places. Trying to hide our faces. Meeting behind closed doors. Wondering who knows. First rule of cheating is don't get caught.
That's a classic from Lee Shot Williams.
Oh, don't get caught, yeah.
The first rule of cheating, whether you're using Ashley Madison or just stooping a colleague in the workplace, is don't get caught. Well, Kevin McCarthy dropped out of the race for Republican Speaker of the House and shocked a lot of his colleagues today. And he said, well, he didn't have the votes. He couldn't lead the party forward. A lot of people are upset because he was honest about the politics of the Benghazi investigation last week. But I think the real reason is that Kevin McCarthy realized that his secret affair, allegedly with Congresswoman Renee Elmers, would be exposed at some point sooner or later. And he would add to the rogues gallery of Republican speakers who got caught cheating, like Newt Gingrich, the guy who replaced him for a minute, Bob Livingston. Then, of course, we had Dennis Hastert, who was thought to be squeaky clean, and now we know that he was sexually harassing or assaulting or in inappropriate relationships with boys on a high school wrestling team that he coached years ago. And so, what, four out of the last five Republican speakers, do I have that right? Gingrich, Livingston, Hastert. Okay, three out of four of the last Republican speakers have had skeletons in their closets. And Kevin McCarthy was about to join their ranks. Now, what's really notable about this is that the corporate media has remained silent. And I challenge you to do what I did. Go to Google and enter the words Kevin McCarthy and affair. When I did it, it produces 3,080,000 results. Now, I didn't look at each and every one of them, but if you just scan page one here, The Week magazine, Catholic Online, they have stories about the not-so-secret affair. Then Mediate, I guess it's called, reports that somebody with a government IP address went in and edited the Wikipedia file of Kevin McCarthy in order to include this alleged affair. GotNews.com reports it was hit with a cease and desist letter from Renee Elmer's lawyer. And then right-wing news, rumored Renee Elmer's affair helps drive establishment, dot, dot, dot. And Crooks and Liars, that's a lefty site. They have the story as well. But last night on MSNBC, with a lot of drama and, you know, a lot of hot air, Rachel Maddow noted that Walter Jones, a deeply religious conservative Republican from North Carolina, who has distinguished himself by opposing spying and torture and our wars, he wrote a cryptic letter to the leadership. He said, I've been serving for 20 years in Congress. Some of the most difficult times have been when our Republican leaders must step down because of skeletons in their closets. We've seen it with Gingrich, Livingston. Let's learn from the past and not go down that road again. Let's make sure the new House Republican leadership team is full of individuals who can do the job without distractions that further degrade the public's trust in the people's house. Now, I have to believe that Rachel Maddow knows what I know. She's got Google. And yet she played coy. Now, maybe NBC's lawyers told her, Rachel, we don't want to be in the same situation as this website called GotNews.com that is getting, you know, pounded with letters claiming defamation from Congresswoman Elmers. Maybe that's the reason. But it's hard to believe that there isn't a single soul in corporate media in this country who would at least report the reports. And so why did the corporate media in the United States go to such great lengths to protect Kevin McCarthy from something that's not a secret? It's hard to grok. Yesterday, we noted that the fiery congressman from Florida, now running for the U.S. Senate, Alan Grayson, filed a complaint with the House Ethics Committee over McCarthy and Trey Gowdy's management of the Select Committee on Benghazi. And he's crowing today. Grayson claims the scalp. Here, he says, when Democrats with guts stand up to corrupt Republicans, we get results. This is a victory against the new McCarthyism and the Republican witch hunt against Hillary Clinton. Well, I think it was more about the not-so-secret affair. The other surprise inside the Beltway today is that Hillary Clinton has separated herself further from the Obama administration. And before I get into the details of Hillary's new position on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, let's look back at this time in the year 2000, actually in 1999, heading into the 2000 elections, when Al Gore struggled to separate himself from the Clinton administration. And, of course, we'd had the Lewinsky affair, the attempted impeachment. And Al was saying, well, you know, I don't want to get too close to Bill Clinton because a lot of people have judged him negatively. Many people believe that while the election was stolen in Florida and in the 5-4 Supreme Court vote, that had Al Gore embraced Bill Clinton's political legacy and not the Lewinsky legacy, he might have fared better with the voters. And so Hillary is clearly separating herself from the guy who just a few years ago was her boss. And in this case, it's on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And I was a little surprised. I was watching the PBS NewsHour last night, and Judy Woodruff interviewed Hillary Clinton in Iowa. And listen carefully to the way Hillary describes her position. She says, well, she sets a high bar for trade deals. But based on what I know so far, I can't support this agreement. The bar here is very high, and based on what I have seen, I don't believe this agreement has met it. Now, this leaves a lot of wiggle room because it's based on what she knows so far. And Hillary is inferring what we all know, and that is that we don't know what the hell is in the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal because it's been negotiated in secret. And while she was Secretary of State, she was certainly privy to the drafts and to the talking points and the positions and proposals. And it appeared that Hillary was going to avoid taking a position on this and the Keystone XL pipeline for as long as she possibly could. And I regard this as a case of Me Too, that Hillary is looking at the increase in Bernie Sanders' popularity that is linked to his longtime opposition to the TPP and to NAFTA, other trade deals. And she's saying, well, for the purposes of the primary, it's better to throw Obama under the bus on TPP than confront a position different from Senator Sanders. Martin O'Malley, who I think is a credible candidate, and I still can't understand why he's running at only 2% in the polls, is quoted as saying, wow, that's a reversal. And Reince Priebus, the head of the Republican National Committee, called Hillary's position a case study in political expediency. And for the moment, I'll agree with Priebus on that. I think this is just political posturing, and it kind of shows that Hillary considers issues just as marketing devices. So it'll be interesting to see if she uses the wiggle room in her answer once she gets to read the TPP draft, and presumably all of us will in the next month or so. And so she ultimately could pivot into support of the TPP, maybe after the debate season is behind her. I do support Bernie Sanders for president. But I've been very clear with my listeners that I have serious issues with his positions on foreign policy, his refusal to talk about the war in Syria in any detail, the war in Iraq, the whatever war in Afghanistan. Now, he voted against going into Iraq in 2002. That's fine. But Sanders has a lot of fleshing out to do, and I understand how political campaigns work, and he's focusing on the issues and the positions that will get him the most support, build momentum, and carry him forward into the primaries. But that doesn't mean that people like me go silent when we disagree with his positions and his political tactics. And so I'm linking to an article that was published today, and a friend on Facebook shared it with me, written by Mickey Hurton. And Mr. Hurton is the former editor of the Burlington Free Press in Burlington, Vermont. It's a pretty liberal paper. And as he points out, one would expect that the paper and the editorial board and Bernie Sanders were all on the same page. But he says they weren't. Sanders was always full of himself, pious, self-righteous, utterly humorless. Burdened by the cross of his socialist crusade, he was a scold whose counterculture moralizing appealed to the state's liberal sensibilities as well as conservatives, who embraced his gun ownership stance, his defense of individual rights, and antipathy toward big corporations, and generally speaking, his stick-it-to-them approach of politics. Now, I know Bernie Sanders. I've never had dinner with him, never been to his house. But I've spent a lot of time with him, perhaps a total of 12 hours of interviews and conversation over the years. And I have to agree with most of these characterizations. He is generally humorless. He's very serious, very moralistic about his positions. And when you agree with him, you say, that's passion. But when you don't agree with him, like the way he shuts down and silences people who come to his town hall meetings who don't agree with his support of Israel, then those characteristics, those traits, can become troubling or even negative. So Hurton tells the story of how in one editorial board meeting, Hurton tried to press Sanders about why he wouldn't endorse others who were seeking city council seats in Burlington. And Sanders wasn't having much of it, and at a certain point he jumped out of his seat, told me, Hurton, to go fuck myself, and stormed out of the edit board meeting. He says, now maybe my persistence bordered on hectoring, but I felt he ought to provide an honest answer. Now he returned to the meeting about 5 minutes after the outburst and continued. And he quotes Chris Graff, longtime Associated Press bureau chief in Vermont, Bernie has no social skills, no sense of humor. He's quick to boil over. He's the most unpolitical person in politics I've ever come across. These and other people characterize the senator as rude, short-tempered, occasionally downright hostile. So I think these are honest and accurate descriptions of Bernie Sanders. Would that make him a bad president? I don't know. I'm of the view that the personal traits of the president are secondary to the work that they do, the actions that they take. And I'm pretty convinced that Bernie Sanders would follow through and do what he can to shift the balance of power away from the ultra wealthy in this country, to promote single payer health care and college tuition payments for all. But I think it's important to be honest, not to sugarcoat or duck the warts that we find on these very human candidates. Now, next Tuesday is the first formal Democratic debate, and one candidate who hasn't been invited is Professor Lawrence Lessig from Harvard. Now, he used to be at Stanford here. I've talked to Larry Lessig. You can find the interview from a year ago if you search for Lessig at peterbcollins.com. Now, he is running an admittedly single-issue campaign about money in politics. And while I think in many ways, this isn't the best way to do it, he has chosen to formally file as a presidential candidate, and in an email that I received yesterday, his staff ticks off what he has done to qualify for the debates being held by the networks. He's raised over $1 million from 8,000 donors. He has a professional campaign team. He has a substantial advertising buy in Iowa and New Hampshire. And he has raised significant funds across America in order to meet the federal matching funds criteria. And this statement goes on, while Lessig, the ultimate outsider, has done these and other Democratic candidates for president have not, namely Senator Jim Webb, Governor Lincoln Chafee, and Governor Martin O'Malley, all three of those candidates have been invited to the first Democratic debate in Las Vegas, and Lawrence Lessig has not. Now, the whole way these debates are being managed, I think, is offensive. The Democratic National Committee has tried to limit the number of debates in a clear effort to help Hillary Clinton. Some of them are scheduled on the weekends and outside of prime time. Rachel Maddow announced that the DNC has approved a forum set for early November, I think. But it's not a debate. She will be interviewing the candidates one at a time. Now, that may be a useful way to learn about the candidates. I'm not opposed to it. But Sanders has called for more debates. He's willing to debate the other candidates with or without Hillary. But the DNC says that if you don't toe the line with their limited debate plan, you'll be penalized in superdelegates. And there are other ways that the DNC can make it quite unattractive for you to break their rules. Every day I like to pause and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Anna Gordonier, Mona Kobus, Kevin Beckley, Keith Hull. They are all monthly subscribers, and I'm grateful for their support. I invite you to join them, and I've been mentioning that I have some extra bills to pay right now because we just did a complete redesign of the peterbcollins.com website to make it more friendly to your smartphones and mobile devices. And I got to pay the piper here. I know his name is John. The bill is on my desk, and I need your help to pay it. So come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu button on the upper right, and it pulls down, and then you click on Become a Subscriber. On the next page, you can choose the amount, whatever's comfortable for you. You can make a one-time contribution. We have the 24-hour pass if there's an in-depth interview you're just dying to hear. So there are many ways you can support us. And if you don't like PayPal, you can mail in a check, a money order, or cash to P.O. Box 100, Mill Valley, California, 94942. There are many ways you can do it. I hope you'll find one that suits you and show your support for the work I'm doing and help out with the costs. This one really caught my attention. Sabrina D'Souza used to work for the CIA. She was one of 26 people involved in the 2003 kidnapping, a bungled, botched CIA operation in Milan, Italy, where they grabbed an Egyptian cleric off the street in broad daylight, using cell phones that could be traced. I mean, it was such an amateurish operation. And as a result, 26, including D'Souza, were convicted by the Italians in absentia because the CIA wouldn't let them participate in the entire trial. Now, we interviewed Sabrina D'Souza 2 years ago, and I'm linking in the show file to this podcast to our conversation from August of 2013. And Sabrina D'Souza is a complicated person. She's a native of the nation of India. And so you'll hear her accent as I play a clip from my interview with her 2 years ago. And she doesn't completely reject the CIA's operations on the dark side of kidnapping people. And in the case of Abu Omar, sending him back to Egypt where he was tortured and they knew he would be. But with that said, Sabrina D'Souza has been cut loose by the CIA. She's on her own. And the news today is that she was arrested at Lisbon Airport in Portugal this past Monday, and she is being held there because they seized her passport, awaiting word from Italy about whether they will request her extradition. And one of the things I discovered in my conversation with Sabrina D'Souza is that she was not even present in Milan on the day of the kidnapping in 2003. Yes, she was part of the scheme, because she was assigned to do it. And as you're about to hear, there was a dispute among the CIA people about whether to conduct this operation. And she's going to make a reference to Bob Lady, who was the CIA base chief in Milan, who opposed the plan and even tried to alert the Italian his Italian colleagues to stop it. Here's an excerpt from that conversation 2 years ago with Sabrina D'Souza.
You know, anti-American sentiment is at an all-time high. And what I fear, having served as a diplomat overseas, and then you see what happened in Benghazi, is, you know, anger against these policies directed at the United States is then turned around and directed at those who are most vulnerable and accessible, the ones, the people serving in our military, in our bases, in our embassies. That's why you have Ambassador Stevens, you see, dead for a decision made in Washington. Mm-hmm. Abu Omar, Bob Lady gets arrested for a decision made, bad decision made in Washington.
Bob Lady, by the way, the Milan station chief.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yeah. And absolutely, the United States did exactly what it should do and get him out of that situation, because at the end of the day, it's so ridiculous. Here's the one person who was so adamant against it, was so concerned about it. You know, he even tried to go to the Italian intelligence chief in Milan saying, hey, please go tell your people that, you know, this is not a good thing to stop it, after Sismi pulled out of it. And he's the one who's, you know, suffered a great deal over this whole thing. And the ones who really authorized it, no, they're all here in Washington. I mean, this is, Peter, this is classic Washington cover-up.
Yes, and you're disposable.
Yeah, the scapegoatry, you know. It starts off with, oh, how are we going to protect self-preservation? And then, oh, let's look around and see who we can scapegoat in this whole sorry affair.
And this is another case where Barack Obama decided not to investigate, not to prosecute the wrongdoing of his predecessors. And so, as she points out, the people who made the decision in Washington, they got promoted. They got book deals. And she is now stranded in Lisbon, Portugal. Perhaps a human without a country anymore. Got three stories for you today about the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Over at the scrappy news site whowhatwhy.com, Russ Baker and his colleagues have published an important story based on documents from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And the FBI is envisioning a future in which its agents will be able to use a small handheld device to collect fingerprints and pictures in the field and add them to a massive biometrics database. Now, recently, if you're a regular listener, you've heard me talk about how on my recent return from Spain, I entered the country in Atlanta. And the first thing I did at the airport is approach a kiosk where I scanned my passport, and they took a brand new picture of me right there. And I know that that new picture is going to go into a database with my old picture, maybe some pictures from my driver's license files, maybe pictures from Facebook, maybe the mugshot from the Peter B. Collins website. They're collecting massive data. And it's not just on criminals or criminal suspects, not just on terrorists or terrorist suspects. It's on everybody. They're claiming that because of the demand for background checks, they have merged their databases from criminal sources along with those that are considered part of their civil database. Now, this is all part of what's called the RISC program, RISC, Repository for Individuals of Special Concern. Now, ostensibly, this is all about fighting terrorism. The FBI told Congress that it would put sharp limits. It would only use criminal mugshots to populate the database, not photos from Facebook, closed-circuit cameras. But EFF believes the new software will be used more broadly. They say the Department of Justice must tell us how it will collect, use, and protect facial recognition data, but there's been no response. And as I mentioned, the FBI has consolidated civil and criminal fingerprints into a single database. Now, keep in mind, they have really soft-pedaled this. But in recent years, it's been shown that the FBI's use of fingerprints is not 100% accurate, as the Bureau has claimed for decades. And we also know that other data collected by the agency is not nearly as useful and conclusive as they argue. So this article goes on, these files could arguably also contain information on the movement of citizens, for example, on the types of rallies they attend or where they go to church. And the EFF says this is not okay. The government should not collect information on Americans for a non-criminal purpose and then use that same information for criminal purposes. I fully agree with that. James Comey, the too tall director of the FBI, last year lamented that his agency doesn't have accurate data on the number of police killings of Americans. Despite that, James Comey told Congress at the end of September that the FBI will try to collect more information, but it doesn't want to mandate, require, the reporting of this data to the FBI by local law enforcement agencies. And I don't know who got to him or what it will take to turn this around. Senator Boxer from California and Booker from New Jersey have proposed legislation to mandate reporting of comprehensive data on the use of deadly force, but it is currently in committee. One more story on the FBI that starts out kind of promising. They claim they have busted up four attempts in the last 5 years by gangs with suspected ties to Russian sources who have been trying to sell cesium, that is a radioactive material, to the Islamic State. Now, this creates all kinds of dark potentials. The creation of a dirty bomb, where you take a conventional weapon and you just kind of attach a nuclear radioactive material to it. You drop the bomb, and then the radioactivity is dispersed along with the munitions. So the FBI has been working on this, but in a fashion that is far too typical. According to the Associated Press, the busts were undercut by striking shortcomings. The kingpins got away. Those arrested evaded long prison sentences, sometimes quickly returning to nuclear smuggling. The FBI used all the toys they use here in the country now. They videotaped arrests. They photographed the bomb-grade material. Well, the Associated Press found a troubling vulnerability in the anti-smuggling strategy. From the first known Moldovan case in 2010 to the most recent, a pattern has emerged. Authorities pounce on suspects in the early stages of a deal, giving the ringleaders a chance to escape with their nuclear contraband, an indication that the threat from the nuclear black market in the Balkans is far from under control. And so once again, we have this agency that promotes itself as the best in the world, keeping Americans safe, and they bulldoze our constitutional rights, and then they screw it up when they attempt to do the job they're really supposed to be conducting. I got an email today with some interesting news regarding the conflict between state laws regarding marijuana and federal law. And I have repeatedly, perhaps to the point of your frustration, talked about how Barack Obama could change this overnight by rescheduling marijuana under the scheme of the Drug Enforcement Act. And I am shocked that this comes from the Republican chair of the Appropriations Committee, Mississippi Senator Thad Cochran. But he has announced some amendments to these continuing resolutions that fund the government that would fix some of the most serious problems we have in this conflict between state and federal law. So this is a funding bill And these amendments say, for example, none of the funds made available to the Department of Justice may be used with respect to any state, and they name all the states that have legalized medical marijuana, or with respect to the District of Columbia, where the voters legalized recreational marijuana and the Congress overruled them. Well, Thad Cochran is ready to overrule the Congress on that, and more power to him. Now, the bill goes on to limit federal restrictions on the use of hemp, to authorize the Veterans Department at VA hospitals to permit medical marijuana usage by veterans when it does not conflict with state law. And here's the real doozy. This is the one we've been waiting for, because in Colorado, in Washington State, we have legal marijuana dealers who cannot put their cash in the bank because the banks say we're regulated by the feds, it's against federal law, the feds could come and seize the bank. So Cochran's amendment reads, none of the funds made available in this act may be used with respect to a state where marijuana is legal for recreational or medicinal purposes to prohibit or penalize a financial institution solely because the institution provides financial services to an entity that's a manufacturer, producer, or person who participates in any business that involves handling marijuana or marijuana products or engages in such activity to a law established by a state or a unit of local government. Wow. I never thought I would accuse Thad Cochran of rational, almost progressive proposals. But I think I just did. Hey, thanks for listening all the way to the bitter end here to my news and comment podcast. I bring you one every day. And you are free to share it far and wide. Put it on Facebook, share it there, click like. And then we'll all just feel real good. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.